So we have a brand new episode of Merchantry Podcast, but this is very different. I have a really interesting person and a really interesting format. For the first time, we are going to have this episode playing both on Merchantry as well as Subscription Radio. And I have with me the host of Subscription Radio and also a really cool e-commerce veteran, Ben Fisher. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Ashwin. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you. So this has been in plans for, I guess, 6 months now. So I'm really glad that we found the time to do this. And I have so many questions. Yes, of course, about subscription and e-commerce and so on. But to begin with, now I'm very fascinated by your journey, right? And there are founders, there are entrepreneurs who take one problem and solve it for the rest of their lives. So you're a post-purchase experience veteran in the CPG and e-commerce space, right? One-click pony, Carthook, Rodeo, they're all in the adjacent spaces. Was it planned that way, or like how did that happen?
Yeah, so it was planned. I'll say before that, I started building companies, well, we'll call it professionally, as an adult around 14 years ago. And early on, my background's as a developer and designer, and one of the early challenges I had was coming up with really cool ideas, but struggling to monetize it. And so after my second company, soon after college, I looked around and I was like, I'm going to focus on ways to help other entrepreneurs make more money, because that's a pretty straightforward business model. And when I looked around in categories, e-commerce was the obvious one. And so Carthook, so the funny thing is I actually built One-Click Pony before doing Carthook, but at the time, I didn't have experience in e-commerce. I had an idea. The idea was a one-click buy button that could be embedded in email. Amazon's patent had literally just expired. It's actually funny seeing Fastbolt, a lot of one-click payment companies coming out in the last like few years. Oh, I know Bolt's been working on it for a while. But long story short, working on One-Click Pony was how I met my future co-founder of Carthook, Jordan. Jordan was an e-commerce merchant himself who was looking for a technical co-founder. At the time, Jordan was building out like a cart abandonment app. So it was helping recover abandoned shopping carts. And so that was a product that he had used himself as a merchant, and he had built and sold an e-commerce brand. When he and I linked up, that was the original idea for Carthook. I loved that he had a lot of domain expertise, specifically in e-commerce. I really had a lot of experience on the B2B SaaS side, and I was looking for someone who, quite frankly, was like a deep expert within e-commerce. And so for the next several years, we were building out the cart abandonment app, and that pivoted into the time. This is like relatively early Shopify days. Like Shopify was still private. And I think Recharge had fairly recently launched. And so I think Shopify was like our third or fourth integration. Like we started off in like a bunch of like random e-commerce platforms and AmeriCommerce and BigCommerce, then Shopify. And we just saw all this energy in the Shopify ecosystem and then identified this challenge around abandoned carts on Shopify. And then as we were digging in and talking to our merchants, we saw this even bigger demand for, at the time, was like a one-page checkout and post-purchase upsells. We saw a lot of people coming from ClickFunnels, previously selling info products, and they were trying to get into drop shipping, and they couldn't sell the way that they could sell on ClickFunnels on Shopify. So we took a bit of a massive pivot in the business based off of all of the feedback and conversations we were having with merchants. And that's when Carthook became the product that people got to know. At that point, I had already decided that, yes, I want to focus on e-commerce. It's like a huge market. I love building tools and building products that help entrepreneurs make more money. And so to that extent, yes, it was perfectly planned. But after the pain of early on coming up with products and not being able to figure out how to monetize them, during that experience with Carthook, I'll say I fell in love with e-commerce, learned a whole lot more of it, sort of like we'll say on the ground, and then working with all of the merchants. And then even after I left Carthook, there was a brief period between Carthook and starting Rodeo. I was consulting as a fractional CTO for subscription e-commerce brands who sold CPG products. And so I was already sort of like, all right, I've picked a lane. I'm going to stay in this lane and then try to leverage that as, we call it my unfair advantage.
Yeah, all the life's mission.
Yeah.
So one more question before we go into the big, bad, beautiful world of subscription, right? So One-Click Pony, who named it? Such a beautiful name.
I did. Thank you.
That's awesome name. Is there a history behind it? Is there trivia behind it?
I have always loved naming. And so I mentioned my background as a designer and programmer. So I worked in advertising during college. Like, all my internships were at ad agencies. I was a flash developer and designer. And so, like, branding and even my portfolio for my work back then is online. So I've always had a lot of fun naming things. And obviously one click, one click buy button at the time. And then I just thought it sounded the Pony Express. And it just sounded like sort of fun and easy to use. And the irony of that is that Rodeo is an evolution of One Click Pony. And so we still played with the horse piece. And so we're like, well, if it's not going to be a pony, what's it going to be, a horse? And then One Click Horse. And so anyways, that's where we kind of were playing around the idea and came up with Rodeo. Still fun.
Yeah, I saw this on your About Us page where you say, we are Rodeo because this is not our first Rodeo. Right?
Yeah.
So that was cool, right? So let's launch into the topic for the day, which is, of course, subscription, right? So, I was digging into some macro numbers as we were planning for this conversation. Something just jumped out of the research I was doing, right? So I think 2020 and 2021 were pivotal years for e-commerce, that everyone understands. But I didn't realize subscription also got a huge boost, right? So from an average of 2 subscriptions per average American household to 5 subscriptions, from $38 per subscription to $190, $200 per month. So it seemed like 2020, 2021 were the Wild West for subscription commerce. And so I got into digging further. So I was looking at the discretionary spend budget for an average American household. So if you look at the typical categories like grocery, personal care, apparel, entertainment, and so on, where you would see subscription products, $900 is what like an average American household will spend on these categories. 22% of that is $200. And that's how much a household spends on subscription. That seemed huge. I thought subscription would be 10% of their discretionary. 22, I wasn't ready for it. So, did this all happen during the pandemic? This shape your journey towards Rodeo? Like, how do you see these numbers?
I mean, I would say that, the numbers are really separate from, those particular numbers are separate from just, I'd say, the trend that I saw at Cart Hook. And also in my own life. So I'm like an automations nerd where I've had an assistant for 10 years. I've automated everything from at one point, my assistant was running an Airbnb that was paying for my rent. I had a nutritionist who did my macros and then ordered my food and had it delivered to me wherever I was in the world. Like, literally there's a service that basically you'll do a weigh-in every week and they will use Grubhub's API to find foods that basically have the nutritional contents or the macros you need to try to get to your weight loss goal or your whatever your goal is. And so I lost 30 pounds ahead of my wedding just using the subscription service. And so for me, subscriptions have always been a big piece of my life. And then looking at and talking to merchants, especially in Shopify, I saw it as this is a genie out of the bottle. And I was like, why wouldn't, if I'm doing this, and I would certainly consider myself an early adopter. I live in New York City. I'm 37 now, but at the time, I was probably 30. Well, I guess when I was going through this observation around subscription, I was in my late 20s. And I was just like, this makes so much sense generally. So those numbers don't surprise me. I think the flip side of that too, though, is if you're talking about $200, I don't know what the average order value is actually of a typical CPG product, but let's say the average order is $30, $40, whether you're subscribed to Canopy or Jot Coffee or Mudwater or whatever. When you talk about subscriptions, we're not talking about Netflix and Hulu, which are I know they keep increasing the prices, but those are $10 subscriptions. With CPG, we're talking about much higher average order value. And so the $200 isn't that surprising if it's, let's assume the average order value is $35, $40. That's, I guess, around 5 things.
Yeah, that's in the ballpark. Yeah.
Yeah.
But in terms of growth rate, right? So, I was reading through Toby's letter last week as they announced the Shopify layoff. Nobody expected e-commerce to grow that fast. And it was at its peak, 17% of retail sometime in 2021. Now it's back to 14%. And nobody expected that race. Nobody expected that fall either. now we are on the trend line. And that's frustrating for a lot of e-commerce corporate strategy folks, because a lot of predictions were made based on the curve going up. Amazon rented a lot of space, people, Shopify, hired people, all that happened. So I haven't seen similar stat in the subscription world, but I saw something, which is, in our report, we co-authored, right? So we said the growth of subscription commerce between 2020 and 2021 was in the 80% range in terms of GMV, but now it's coming down to 20-30% and so on. Still a good growth rate, I would say. But what's causing this drop? Is it because of the economy? Was it always the COVID aberration that caused that GMV increase?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, COVID accelerated a lot of things. And I think the biggest thing it probably did is it accelerated awareness. And so I can't say how long I thought that growth post-COVID or during COVID would continue. It's not that surprising. I didn't predict it, but it's not that surprising that things have tapered off and kind of gotten back to where they were, would be on the slope. I can speak from the American perspective, or even not even American. I can speak from my perspective as someone living in New York who's super busy. And I think that people my age or our age, I don't actually know your exact age.
I'm just slightly older than you are.
Slightly older? Okay.
Yeah.
I think that as you get older and you have more discretionary income, if you were a millennial, or I guess they called it a bridge millennial, I'm technically a bridge millennial, as you have more money and less time, generally what you do is you use the money to buy back your time. And so I think subscriptions, and we saw this also with Amazon, right? Amazon introduced Subscribe and Save however long ago. I think that there are aspects of subscription that can be super convenient, because you don't want to have to think about it. And I think most of us, part of the reason I've eaten the same meal every single day for the last 8 years for lunch is I just wanted to make a decision and not have to think about it again, because it's the same decision I have to make every single day. And no one wants to think about when they have to buy toilet paper again. No one wants to have to think about when they have to get more coffee. With that said, subscription is not perfect. And so I think that the familiarity with subscription as a business model, as well as just, I think, more and more brands offering subscription, with the whole D2C channel blowing up. Now shoppers, wherever they go, they see a subscription option, which I don't think was certainly not as true before. And so I think it's also a matter of that. What do you think?
Yeah.
What's your purview? Well,
I have tried subscription products on and off, but I like to change my lunch every afternoon.
Yeah.
So I'm that kind of a guy.
Yeah.
But there are some products that I buy, shaving creams and deodorants and so on, that I'm not going to change. Mm-hmm. So I do subscriptions for all of them. Right. But there was fascination for buying socks online and on subscription model. But now I have maybe 200 socks, pairs of socks. So I'm not going to.
Right.
I'll stop that subscription. Right. So that's my tryst with subscription. But it's interesting you talked about CPG as a category, D2C as a model within that. The new customer versus repeat customer for a CPG brand, which is on the D2C channel. Right.
Yeah.
So if you look at those numbers between, say, 2022 quarter one versus 2022 quarter two, which is the recent numbers, recent quarters that we have, the new customer addition has actually slowed down. Or in fact, I would say there is negative growth, right? There's a decline in new customer addition by 10%. It's slightly better this quarter, it's 8% or so on. But what's really saving the day is repeat customers. That's also declining. I think that's the function of the market that we are in. But in Q1, repeat customers accounted for nearly 40% of the growth for CPG. In Q2, it's about 25%. But it's positive, unlike new customer addition growth, which is negative, right? So I think that kind of sets the tone for the importance of subscription or importance of loyalty and bringing the customers back and so on, right? So in the world that you're in, you have a good view of how brands are reacting to the downturn or recession. I don't know what the definitions these days are, but do you see brands talking more and more about subscription or at least repeat purchases?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I think this goes back to brick and mortar businesses, but it's there's basically, three ways to make money. And there's always that, we'll go back to the cliche thing of an existing customer's worth, however, let's say 10 times more than a new customer, right? That's not new. And so in business, it's always been that basically you to build a great business, you basically need frequency and then increasing average order value. Because ultimately, lifetime value is like the lifeblood. I mean, you can get into the nuances of that around cash flow. Like the lifetime value over the course of 10 years matters. But like for most brands, they need a 90-day payback period on their ad spend. So it's more nuanced than that. But what I'll say ultimately is that, you know, this idea around like, how do you get people to come back and repurchase? And then how do you also get them to ideally spend more when they come back? You know, those are really, I guess we saw that firsthand with Carthook, where the whole value of Carthook was enabling people to, in many ways, make their profit on the first purchase through the upsell. They'd break even on the original purchase. They'd like basically advertise on Facebook or Instagram, like the winning product, the product they knew had like the most amount of interest. And then they would invest money. They would try to at least break even on the first purchase. And then they would make the gravy through the upsells, the post-purchase upsells. And so it's not that surprising to me. I'm curious with that number that you see returning customers, if that includes subscribers or not. Because I think when most people talk about returning customers, I don't know how much visibility any company has into the recurring revenue of an e-commerce brand. Because when I look at, one thing I'll tell you is when I look at like any of the products out there that estimate store revenue, and granted, the way that a lot of those sites do it is they'll buy an order, wait a day and buy another order, and they'll see how many, like what's the gap between purchases. But by and large, I think a lot of them don't reflect subscription purchases, which if you're measuring by the gap in orders, that wouldn't make sense. But I think there's a lot of different ways that, I mean, including Pipe Candy, I mean, like that you could go about trying to estimate revenue of a brand. But what I'll say is like subscription brands have always seen drastically underestimated in their revenue when I've looked on any, whether it's on any of these different sites. And so I think that's really interesting. And what I will typically say is I typically see around at least 50% of a store's customers, if you offer subscriptions, about half of them are subscribers. And those 50% of subscribers probably represent about 60 to 70% of the store's revenue. And that goes back to the importance of everyone. Well, it goes back to just like everyone who's offering a subscription model, they want subscribers. And I've even seen a lot of brands not even offer one-time purchases of their products, but instead just trying to push the subscription model. I've always pushed back on that because as a customer and as a consumer, that drives me freaking bonkers. But what I'll say is the trend that I've seen, and in some ways, I think VC money has pushed this in part because every brand, every CPG brand wants to say that they're a subscription brand. What's weird about that to me, though, is it's not really a subscription in the sense of like, you can't skip paying a month of Netflix, right? Like you can't skip a month of paying for Adobe Cloud. When you talk about recurring revenue, especially as someone in B2B SaaS, recurring revenue is recurring revenue. In CPG, a lot of the challenges are around anticipating replenishment. And so this idea of the fact is that people need to be able to skip, people need to be able to pause. The number one reason people cancel is too much product. It's product pileup. I think the weird thing of that is that the subscription model, as powerful as it is and as attractive as it is for a lot of e-commerce brands, it's not always the right move for the consumer. The truth is that going back to your stat, I think once most consumers find something that they like, they'll stick with it as long as they have a great brand experience. And so my guess is going back to COVID, a lot of people were exposed to brands that they'd never experienced before. And so they developed some habits. And so, yes, returning customers is going to be, or is naturally higher if they had a good experience. The drop in customer acquisition is not surprising because brands have really pulled back on ad spend. Part of that is due to like iOS changes and Facebook, but then also then you combine that with like the pullback in VC investment in like the category. So I'd say the customer acquisition piece is not surprising at all. The returning customer piece, I think, is more just, it makes sense. And it's also like the lifeblood of any brand. And one of the things I tell brands, especially subscription brands, is if you don't have a way of offering flexibility beyond just flexibility within the subscription or membership, as a consumer, like no one wants to be locked into something. And so if you're only offering subscriptions, for example, how are you getting returning customers, right? Like if your subscription model, and going back to your stat, let's say the average American household spends $200, and let's say that represents four brands. Now there's like thousands of companies offering subscriptions. So how many brands in parallel is someone actually going to subscribe to? You're not going to have a subscription to everything. And given that the average order value is so high, like it's from a financial perspective, not possible.
It's reckless.
Well, sorry, I know we kind of went on a tangent, but I was going to say one other thing I've been thinking a lot about is like, I think it was like a triangle where most people will probably have a primary subscription in a category, or they'll have their primary, like one or two subscriptions. Then they'll have secondary and tertiary subscriptions. And so those are things where like their primary subscriptions, maybe like their favorite coffee, that like Jot or whatever, where they're like, I know I want this every few weeks to show up to my house. And then they'll experiment with or incorporate some, I would say some flavor in exploring and incorporating like other brands in the mix over the course of a year. But they're not going to be subscribing in parallel to like 10 different products.
That's right. So in fact, I was speaking to Leo of Repeat.
Of Repeat, yeah.
I think the stat, if I remember it right, came from them. I think this is public information, but they are processing little over $500 million or $1 billion. I don't remember. Like, so in those transactions, they separate between repeats versus like new customers. And that's kind of, that number looked very fascinating to me, right? So, I mean, if I'm a brand and I've spoken to a few brands, right? So, I mean, all of them are interested in subscription because for the obvious reasons that you just mentioned, cost of acquisition and like lifetime value and so on. But there is also an inertia I've observed in some brands, especially because there was an uncertain supply chain issue and the cost of warehousing, all of that increasing. And you know what? Subscription is important, but I struggle to get traffic to my website. Only if I get traffic to my website do I even get the subscription in place. So might as well surrender to Amazon. I'll put it up on Amazon, like Amazon has a subscribe and save. Maybe I should try that first and see how that goes before I lock into a subscription model for myself. I need to do a technology stack investment, so on and so forth, right? So the combination of access to prime customers and FBA and a subscribe and save, all of them look interesting. So if you are an advisor to a brand, which I think you are, like in the capacity of like building a technology stack, between launching subscription service versus some kind of a repeatability stack versus Amazon, how would you sequence this?
I mean, and this is like one of those examples where I will say what I'm really good at. And I am not a marketer. I'm not a merchant. As much as I have spent time with merchants and I've spent a lot of time in CPG, and a lot of my friends are merchants, I'm not an expert in like what that sequence should be. What I've observed and what I've had friends tell me is it depends. This is probably, to whatever extent there is a truth, this is the truth, is there's a mix. As a consumer, I spend a lot of time on Amazon because it's convenient to buy things together. And so if you sell a product that typically would be purchased along with other products that a consumer typically buy on Amazon, it would make sense at some stage of your business to invest in Amazon. The other thing is wholesale. And I think D2C is really just a channel. It's not what for most businesses, like you need to diversify beyond just that. And in addition to like adding more SKUs, adding more channels and distributions, those are the ways to grow an e-commerce brand. I think the fear, understandably, around being on Amazon is the private white, is the, basically Amazon ripping you off. And then also copycats, I'll pick on China, but like copycats, like basically on drop shipping from Alibaba, basically. Those are very real things that are scary, but for the brands, and like one of my mentors who's an e-commerce merchant, known him for about 20 years, he's also happened to be one of our investors. Yeah, he basically was like, as much as he hates Amazon, they do so well through Amazon that they can't ignore it. Like they make more through Amazon than they do through their D2C channel. They also started off doing brick and mortar and Amazon before they did D2C, so they never really built up their D2C channel. But just, I think what he said was, this is someone who spends a lot of time dealing with people copying their brand and doing like knockoffs and trying to enforce your trademark and all these things that don't sound like a whole lot of fun. Depending on the product and depending on the stage of your business, you're probably going to and want to invest in Amazon as a channel. Whether or not you do that after you know, at what stage do you do that? And how soon after, if you start off in D2C, do you do wholesale first before doing Amazon? That sequence, I don't know. And I think that also depends a little bit on your particular product. You certainly lose a lot of the direct connection to your customer, but you would lose that in wholesale too, right? Like that was one of the big things. Like if you sell through Walmart or Target or whatever, you have the same issue as selling with Amazon. But when you look at how much money and like from a cash flow perspective for these brands, like when you get to the stage of actually, or the scale of being able to sell through those, it can be such a substantial amount of money that you just can't ignore it as a business owner. I think so for most people, D2C really becomes the place where you can create a unique consumer experience, and your D2C channel is the place to really double down on that experience. What can you get through your D2C channel that you wouldn't be able to get through Amazon or by buying at Target? And I think there's two things there, one of which Shopify is trying to help with, which is around like, how can Shopify help with operations around fulfillment so that you can compete, at least on like the turnaround time of, yeah, I want it next day or 2 days from now. But I think that's where the subscription model, but also membership, are both really interesting ways for a brand to add additional value through their D2C channel that some consumers might be like, yeah, I'd rather buy on Amazon, but I want these perks of buying it directly through the channel. I'll give you one example. Jot Coffee, who's one of our customers, they have a product that is only available to subscribers. So you can only buy it through their D2C channel. It's basically a artisanal small batch coffee that changes every like month or less. And so that product itself changes also. And so like, that's one of those examples of like having a cool perk where, yeah, like some people might still buy the product through another channel, but ultimately if you love Jot and if you love sort of the experience of it.
New flavor of coffee. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I've also heard that some people, going back to like the report that we collaborated on, like when you dig into like, what are the reasons people subscribe to brands and why do they subscribe to D2C? Curation was one big piece. Another one was feeling like you have a more basically access to higher quality products. And so if going back to just thinking about your subscription experience and thinking about your subscribers, I don't think that this experience shouldn't just be reserved to subscribers. I think that's the other piece of this, is that when you're talking about like repeat purchasers are the folks who are saving the day. Subscription is a business model. It's not how consumers think. I joke like the job to be done is not, as a consumer, I don't care about subscriptions. What I want is the product when I want it and when I need it. So I think that's actually sort of the gap that's been created that I'll say, like, just to completely like tooting our own horn, like that's the gap we're trying to close, which is with One Click Pony. The whole idea was, how can we enable, basically we worked with CPG brands enabling one click buying. And what we would do is we'd send smart reminders to consumers. Again, it's crazy to think, but I originally built this 7 years ago before doing Carthook. But then even when I dusted off One Click Pony after leaving the day-to-day of Carthook, we relaunched that product and we were doing it in CPG. This is like 3 years ago. I looked at it and I was like, you still have this gap between how, like, sometimes people want subscriptions. Sometimes people want to be reminded to replenish. And there's no way to close that gap. And it wasn't until Shopify announced their subscriptions API where I was like, finally, we can take what we were already doing with One Click Pony and try to effectively create a, what I consider like the consumer-centric way of providing a great experience, where it's like, there's a continuum. I don't want to always be a subscriber and I don't always want to be having to think in like buying. And it's like, there's this middle, like there's this wide middle ground that Repeat's done an awesome job bridging that, like, or at least around like the replenishment period, replenishment function. Yeah. That to me is interesting.
Yeah. So the way you framed makes a lot of sense. If you look at the jobs to be done for a consumer, subscription is an industry term. The job to be done is like, my pet is running out of like pet food, like, and he is going to get cranky. So I need it when I need it. Right.
Yeah.
Or I don't need it because like him and I are on road trip. Right. So that's essentially how the job is described. Yeah. That makes total sense. And subscription, like you said, is also in some ways a product of like the amount of money that was available out there in the market to build something that would contractually position what is actually a repeat purchase into a subscription purchase. So on Excel sheets, it makes sense. Just switching gears a little bit, I saw this, I mean, I don't remember who said this, but like, I really like the way they put it. So if you look at Amazon, that's for distribution and that's for top line. If you look at D2C, and subscriptions or repeats, however you want to frame it, that's essentially the frequency part. And with frequency comes loyalty. And with loyalty comes better margins. But if you look at the economy as it stands today, you certainly need margins because you're not going to raise money any soon. So D2C becomes that much more important. Repeatability or repeat customers become that much more important. So that's how you position repeat or like subscription replenishment repetition stack to merchants. But they cannot ignore Amazon, because be it advertising effectiveness inside Amazon or like the FBA part of it, all of that, like Amazon is like making an infrastructure that is too hard to ignore in this climate, in this market, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of brings us to this question of buy with Prime. So you are a one-click veteran, right? So Amazon is now taking this buy button to where the customers are. What is it the Trojan has for? And what is Amazon likely to build next with buy with Prime?
I mean, people have been speculating around, you know, we'll call it like Amazon building, like what is Amazon going to build for brands to sell their own products? They had originally tried building what today is like Shopify. I think Amazon had launched a similar product probably like 10 years ago. I don't remember even what it's called. Yeah. They subsequently killed it. I mean, I think obviously what Amazon wants is to be ubiquitous across the entire internet. And so anywhere that you can buy with Prime, or anywhere that it's convenient for someone to purchase something and you can embed a button to buy, that's really powerful. But I'm not a wizard, so I have no idea what they're doing. But I'd be curious to hear, what are some of your guesses?
So Amazon has hundreds of people likely to be working on Buy with Prime. And that large an organization is not to build Amazon Pay or Buy with Prime the way it is today, because those products like Amazon Pay has been around for a while. I would certainly think that it is a store builder, a Shopify killer, so to speak. Right. So the question is, while Shopify is doing everything they can from an infrastructure standpoint, the Deliverr acquisition that they did now, and the Shop app they have launched and so on. So all of that will bring the distribution and like save some money for like the brands as they think about logistics and returns and so on and so forth. But what is missing for Amazon is how to take its Prime customers who are big spenders to brands who are reluctant to come into Amazon, and how can they make more money for their Amazon advertising business? So Amazon has been traditionally penalizing sellers who are taking traffic out of Amazon, but essentially, I think that's a role reversal, so to speak. So Amazon is encouraging it in some way by, that's kind of what I would think they would do. The revenue they would generate from advertising from brands that are not selling on Amazon, and also Amazon Pay revenue, and understanding and power, what sells through and like and powering the shopping experience for like a brand, there's a lot of positive for them to reverse their approach towards like seller versus a brand which is not part of the marketplace ecosystem. I would strongly believe they would launch a store builder. So what would be interesting to see is, will they think of subscription as a native feature for that store builder? So will Subscribe and Save be a part of that experience? So if that is the case, then it becomes that much more friction-free for brands to embrace that, because all the infrastructure to support subscribers and like sending parcels every month and so on and stopping and starting, all of that is baked into the experience by Amazon, and they just have to like embrace it. I mean, we are speculating, but I think like that's not out of the scope of things, I guess.
It's definitely not out. No, I mean, hey, if I was Amazon, there's no doubt they're coming after, we'll call it this part of the market. I think they have a couple challenges, one of which is reputationally how, reputationally the experience that merchants have had around Amazon, and knowing that it's kind of like once you open that door, you start getting beaten down, everything around competitors, potentially Amazon copying you, losing control of your direct connection to the customer. Now, maybe in this, we'll call it in this store builder world, the brand is able to have a more of a direct connection to its customers. I mean, we're just brainstorming right now. So maybe that would be it. Like, I'm just trying to think of like, what are the reasons why brands wouldn't want to do it? And a big piece is skepticism of Amazon, as well as I think, Amazon's so big. I don't know if they can help themselves of just, you know, their whole thing is getting the customer the lowest possible price. And that's for a lot of D2C brands, or for a lot of brands, they don't want the lowest price. And one of the challenges actually you'll see is you'll see same product, if you're a merchant, advertised for less on Amazon than what you sell it on your store. And so what ends up happening is that's not a great experience either as a brand, whether if you're selling a luxury product or something where you have a certain price point and you're trying to brand yourself, they're basically messing with your own approach to how you're trying to market or position your business in the market. I also think that Amazon, I'm trying to think of consumer products that Amazon has been really successful with, because I feel like what they've been really good at is aggregation, but I haven't seen them. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's anyone's guess. I mean, what you also have happening is this whole headless ecosystem too, right? And so I'm curious if there might be a certain segment of stores that would start with, and maybe it's the smaller ones, maybe it's people who are just starting out, that for them it would be, it's easier to start selling with Amazon Prime Store Builder because it's very similar to dropshipping where you basically probably have like Fulfilled by Amazon built in. There's like a lot of benefits and it takes a lot less cash and like investment in infrastructure from day one. So I could see that. But this is actually the type of question where I'd want to just talk to a bunch of brands and be like, what do you think of this? And like, what are reasons you would or would not do it? And for the brands you don't want to do it, what would it take for you to do it? But I think a lot of stuff, the devil's in the details of what does it actually really enable or not.
I was just watching Amazon's numbers. And one of the things that's fascinating is the fire hose that feeds them, which is the new merchants onboarding onto the marketplace, that has slowed down. Amazon's competitor is not like just Shopify anymore. It's TikTok. So like, you know, I would rather buy from Best Buy, rebrand it with my name, sell it on TikTok and be done with it, right? So why would I set up a shop on Amazon and like pay 40% to them when I can sell it through TikTok and maybe dropship it? And if people are not going to come on Amazon and set up shop, Amazon needs to go to where they are, and the store builder is a way to get there. It still does not like address the competition, which is these video sites which turn into commerce experiences. So this is part of what makes e-commerce very exciting, because video commerce was like in the periphery, but like TikTok is kind of making it a viable channel for you to sell something and make $1 million GMV within 6 months. So who knows? Coming to Rodeo, right? Like, so what is your thesis in the world that is changing with like, you know, easy cash not available, cost of acquisition increasing? So how do you see your role as a company changing, and how are brands approaching you now when compared to like, say, a couple of quarters ago?
Yeah. So, I mean, I see our mission from day one was basically building a consumer-centric experience, like subscription. We would describe it early on as consumer-centric subscription. And not a subscription. Like I've actually joked that we're like an anti-subscription company, where as a consumer, and I've said this, like subscriptions aren't right for everyone. And they're certainly not right over the whole time, over the lifetime of a customer's relationship with a brand, whether you're traveling or whatever. Like the whole point of the subscription business model, which was really built for brands, it wasn't built for the consumer. I've talked to enough people and asked, how convenient is your subscription really? A lot of people, you know, they'll say, oh, it's great not having to think about it. But then the flip side is everyone has stories, even around Amazon Subscribe and Save, of, yeah, but it sucks when you like open up your cabinet and you basically have like a year's worth of like beef jerky, for example. So like the downside around subscriptions, in my experience, is that it can lead to you churning out what would otherwise be a great customer. For me, it's really looking at, I think for the last several years, and even like Recharge was really built from the point of view of merchants, like how to help merchants build, drive repeat purchases, or let me frame that, how to build like recurring revenue. The challenge with that is once everyone's doing that, and if it's not great for consumers, consumers are going to look, are going to gravitate towards solutions that are great for them. And so for us, I almost joke, we're like a therapist, where we're trying to figure out, find a solution that's great for the consumer and great for the brand. Ultimately, what the brand wants and cares about is LTV. They also do care about like basically the payback period, but it's not an either or, it's a spectrum. And so with Rodeo, we really are, I mean, we're trying to bridge that gap, because that to me is where the interesting things exist. There's a lot of things that I would buy on a regular cadence that I just would not subscribe to. The example I've been giving recently is, if you asked me to subscribe to having pizza every Friday, I would say no. Even though growing up, my family had pizza probably every Friday. But if you were to text me or email me on Friday morning or Friday afternoon and say, hey, do you want pizza tonight? I 9 times out of 10 would probably say yes. And so when I think of subscriptions and I think of Rodeo and I think of what we're trying to do, it really is just like there's no doubt you need, like, brands want and need subscriptions, and there's a lot of power in recurring revenue. And I know this as a B2B SaaS founder, but the truth is that 40% of your subscribers each year are canceling, or roughly, approximately so. And they're doing it for reasons that have nothing to do with your product and everything to do about the lack of convenience.
The experience of subscription, yeah.
Yeah, to tie back to what you were asking around, like, what are we doing and what are we hearing from brands? I think that the question really is more focused around how do we build, like, every brand wants to maximize LTV, but they do want some, there's some time sensitivity to that. Every brand wants their customer to be happy, but they also need to be a business. And so a lot of the conversations I have with merchants is no one wants to give up as a brand, that no one wants to give up their subscriptions. Even if you were to look at their data and be like, well, you actually have this huge segment of customers who are canceling. And, you know, you certainly have loyalists who will use, buy your product and subscribe to it, and they don't even care if they have too much of it. But there are customers who frequently skip. And so I would call those as, like, anxious subscribers, where they're like, they're worried about they're going to get an unexpected charge from your brand. And so those are all reasons why someone who would otherwise be buying from you repeatedly cancels. And then at that point, you don't know if they're going to buy from you again, or if they're just going to be buying reactively from an email campaign. Yeah, I mean, there's still a huge amount of bullishness around subscriptions, which, as I said, I think it's a great business model, but there's more nuance to it. And ultimately, and I think it's probably cliche at this point, is, but part of what was great about the D2C category is we were talking about, like, D2C brands were building a great consumer experience. I think what's ironic is that most subscription experiences of a brand, there's really not that much to it beyond basically a contract that I'm going to send force feed you every month. You might save 20% off, but I live in New York City. I have a relatively small kitchen. You're taking up physical space in my apartment. And so I think that with brands, especially with what's happening around VC money, as well as just changes in the economy and uncertainty around the economy, they're going to need, and they're looking for ways to be creative to what I hate saying, like, maximize LTV over and over again, but that's really, it's like, how do you retain your customers in a way then which it works for both the brand as well as for your customer?
In fact, this would be really cool. I don't know if Rodeo does this. So if a brand does subscription, I mean, they can continue doing that. But at the point when someone wants to cancel the subscription, they can route them to the Rodeo workflow, right? So, hey, instead of canceling the subscription, would you want me to remind in a timely cadence?
Yep.
And most likely they are going to say yes.
Yep.
Right. Is that how it works? Or, like, you know, are you replacing subscriptions, or are you kind of, like, working in conjunction with subscriptions?
It's in conjunction. Again, this goes back to that being the therapist, where brands, and also I think from a business perspective, subscriptions make a lot of sense, and compounded interest. when you think of anything, like, it's just not about, no brand, I think brands that have would struggle if they offered everything not as a subscription and people could just buy whenever they wanted. That would be good for the consumer, but probably not good for the brand, and a lot of brands wouldn't be able to survive. And so it goes back to that middle ground where I think it's really about, so with Rodeo, it's about offering flexibility around the subscription or membership where, yes, if someone's going to cancel, providing them with the opportunity instead to, like, pause and effectively get a smart reminder every X days that asks them, hey, are you running low? Do you need more? And then facilitating it so that basically with a single click, they're able to replenish, and there's upsells and cross sells, or they can snooze the reminder. And so again, going back to, like, this tagline I talk about, like, it's like, it's convenience without the commitment. When I talk about a company's customers, your subscribers are automatically replenishing, but then people who aren't subscribing, they're really a reactive customer,
right?
Where they're buying in reaction to your email marketing, or if they think of you. So doing this, what we call, like, the just-in-time subscription or on-demand subscription, is like a happy medium where for most, some people just want a subscription. Some people will never want to subscribe. This is a way to bridge that gap where you can probably get a higher number of people who would otherwise never subscribe to your product. But if you gave them full control over the subscription cadence, then they would. And there are people who experience your product, they like the convenience, but they are either anxiously waiting to be overcharged or charged when they're not expecting it, or worried about pileup. This is, again, a way of keeping someone engaged with your brand without them having to fully leave your, without kicking them out of your program. And there's some mechanics that we've built into the just-in-time subscription or on-demand subscription that help merchants around basically, like, perks, you get certain perks if as long as you're buying within a certain period. But the idea here and the goal here is to give the consumer the control of when they're being charged and making sure that they actually, in fact, want to be replenished.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
That makes a ton of sense. Like, that is the flexibility that will actually keep the customers. It's counterintuitive, but you would rather have that customer repeat like in a predictable manner than completely churn, right?
Yeah.
So we're kind of up on the clock. So yep. And I'm going to throw a few rapid fire questions across to you.
Sure.
So are you a bookworm or like are you a podcast nerd?
Bookworm. But I listen to audiobooks.
Okay. So what's the one that you're listening to now?
I'm actually listening to $100 Million Offers.
Wow. What's that? I've not heard that.
Yeah. It's actually a really great book. It was recommended to me by a friend of mine who works in sales. It's kind of a cheesy title, but so was I Will Teach You to Be Rich, which was also one of the most impactful books in my life by Ramit Sethi. Like, I think, it basically is talking about just how to create it's about crafting offers and about understanding, really, it's about like value, positioning value, your product or your offering around value as opposed to price.
Lovely. I'm going to check that. I've not seen a book like that, I guess. So I've seen books on negotiations, but like creating an offer.
Yeah, it's like a dollar. You can buy it. It's a dollar.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. So if our listeners have to reach out to you for partnerships or mm-hmm. understand more about Rodeo, like what's the best way?
Yeah. So my Twitter handle is skinny and bald because I'm kind of skinny, kind of bald.
Uh-huh.
You can email me at ben@hey.rodeo. And that's hey, H-E-Y, period, rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, Twitter's great. Email's great. Obviously, we also have our subscription podcast, subscriptionradio.com. But yeah, no, anyone who's interested in talking about or nerding out around subscription and e-commerce, we think about this a lot. And for me, coming from both the design and technical side, I spend a lot of my time thinking around the experience and how to improve consumer experiences. So if any merchant ever has any questions or wants to geek out on this stuff, I'm always happy to talk to them and see what suggestions I might have or anyone on our team might have. I think the other thing is like starting with Carthook, I've had a lot of experience navigating and sort of bending the Shopify platform to accomplish things that might not be obvious of how to do or weren't possible to do. And so if anyone's having questions around Shopify and stuff like that too, always happy to help if we can.
Perfect. All right. So I introduced today's guest as Ben Fisher, but like as I see the screen, I think like the name DJ Fish is actually more elegant because, I've seen Ben's subscription radio. I've listened to it. Like he pours his heart and soul into it. Like, and the guests are fantastic. So you should, I mean, I'm not saying this because he's paying money to say this, but like subscription radio is awesome. You should listen to it and follow him on Twitter and check out Rodeo. Thank you so much, DJ Fish. And like, it was fun, like doing the role reversal and hosting awesome. You for a change.
It was uncomfortable. I've never done on this side of the mic before. And I'll say, where can people find you?
Yeah. That's, I mean, I'm on Twitter as well. I'm Ashwinizer, Ashwinzer on Twitter. Cheesy name, but like, forgive me for that. I'm also on LinkedIn, Ashwin Ramasamy.
Yeah, and then they can check out Pipe Candy and...
Right. Google for e-commerce data, search for Pipe Candy and click so that we get some SEO juice.
Yeah.
So, and our reports, we co-authored a report on subscription commerce industry and the state of subscription commerce in 2022. You can find it on hey.rodeo or like pipecandy.com. If you're a statistics nerd, like there's a lot of statistics that you would enjoy reading from that report. It's a free download. Go check it out. Until we meet you on our respective episodes again next month, like it's DJ Fish signing off and Ashwin signing off from Subscription Radio Ashwin, and DJ. Merchant Free, respectively. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, man.